You're listening to a classic business podcast as heard on Classic 1027. 1027.
An important conversation at a policy and a business level as we start to pick through the ways that COVID has changed the business environment forever is the impact that COVID has had on labour and the future of work. The pandemic caused the future of work to arrive early, and in a country with our record levels of unemployment, we must ask to what extent is the pandemic-induced regime of remote work and flexible hours and AI-enabled software and robotic process automation, all of those things here to stay. In two ways that businesses historically have controlled cost and mitigated uncertainty during recessions are by adopting automation and redesigning work processes, which reduce the share of jobs involving mainly routine tasks. In a McKinsey global survey of 800 senior executives in July last year, two-thirds said they were stepping up investment in automation and AI, either somewhat or significantly. And production figures for robotics in China exceeded pre-pandemic levels by June of last year. But artificial intelligence continues to divide some in society. Some hail the ability of machines that can clearly outperform humans in compute and power as a pivotal move towards a post-work society, while others, like Yuval Noah Harari, paint an altogether far more alarming and dystopian future. As Harari says, most people in Birmingham, Joburg, St. Petersburg, and Mumbai are only dimly aware, if they are aware at all, of the rise of AI and its potential impact on their lives. And it's clear, though, that the technological revolutions now gathering momentum will in the next few decades confront humankind with some of the hardest trials it has yet encountered. And it's a subject that was tackled by local renowned artificial intelligence academic and expert Professor Tlhidzi Marwala in his new book, Closing the Gap, The Fourth Industrial Revolution in Africa. Prof. Marwala is the Deputy Vice Chancellor for Research and Internationalization at the University of Johannesburg and a Deputy Chair of the Presidential Commission on 4IR. Great to have you on the show, Prof. And he's joined by Johan Steyn, who is currently with IQ Business, a technology management consulting firm. And Johan is a published author and chair of the Institute of Information Technology Professionals South Africa Special Interest Group on Artificial Intelligence and Robotics. Thanks for joining us too, Johan. Prof, your book looks at the history of previous industrial revolutions and its impact on Africa, and it covers various future scenarios. And you do a lot of research in this area. 20 years ago, though, you were working at SAB, and they had automation already back then. So much of this technology isn't that new. Are we at risk of confusing digital evolutions with revolutions?
Well, I think there's been quite a bit of a change. Because the automation that came as a result of digitization, and the digital computer was invented more than 70 years ago, can you believe it? You know? And out of that came huge amounts of automation. But that automation was automating physical work. You know, you were automating the physical work. What is different now is that you are automating the cognitive work. This is the work of thinking, something that humans actually do very, very well, because muscle power, horses were able to do some of this work. You know, we know about factories that were being run by horses, the horse muscles, before the first industrial revolution. So much of this is a progression, but it is a progression that is taking a cognitive dimension.
And when you say a cognitive dimension, it reminds me of a movie that I had the pleasure of watching recently about AlphaGo, which is the first computer program to beat a human Go player. And Go is this ancient Chinese game, 3,000 years old. It was thought to be almost impossible because of its complexity. I think there's as many permutations or moves on the board as there are atoms in the universe. But a team of AI experts and scientists actually beat a human Go player. So it just shows you how much artificial intelligence, the cognitive side of this revolution, has moved forward. Do we fully grasp that here in South Africa in the discussions that you have at the university and with the business leaders that you meet? Is this revolutionary impact dawning on us?
No, absolutely. If you go to many of our banks, you realize that artificial intelligence is becoming a norm. You know, the chief data scientists are being appointed in many of our corporates because we live in a data age. Where we have to be worried a little bit is in the public sector. And obviously the reason for that is because you have much more expertise on artificial intelligence in the private sector than in the public sector. So when you go to government departments, you don't see the sort of automation that is needed in order to increase productivity and also decrease the levels of poverty. Because when you remove people from key decision-making and replace them with a much, much more effective artificial intelligence machine, then you are going to have less corruption. So I would say that South Africa is not necessarily in the dark ages when it comes to artificial intelligence. Research is being done here. Some of the most effective artificial intelligence algorithms, such as Gaussian models, actually were invented here in South Africa. So we are there, but we are not completely there.
It's about bridging the divide between the private and the public sector. We'll come back to that because you speak a lot about public-private partnerships when it comes to doing this. Johan, from your vantage point, and I'm sure consulting with lots in the private sector in particular, in business leaders who are thinking about how to approach this, being sensitive of the realities in South Africa, record high unemployment levels, there's a talk of these jobs displacing existing workers. So as a business leader, you want to upskill your labor force. But practically, how do you do that? How are business leaders thinking about approaching some of these challenges?
Michael, thanks for having us. And you've just touched on a very important topic, because to become more competitive on the global stage, businesses will have to automate smartly. And there we talk about robotic or intelligent automation. But inevitably, it can and most likely will lead to massive job displacement. If you put a South African lens on it, you think of, as you've alluded to, our unemployment, if you think what's happened to us during these pandemic months, I think a lot of business leaders, if not all, are struggling with this topic, is how do we become more competitive locally and globally, and what do we do with our people? Because it's not no longer just the white-collar or the blue-collar conversation. Even knowledge workers like myself stand a chance of losing my job if I don't keep upskilling. So I think this is where, and we've already alluded to this, where the government and the private sector needs to work together. There's so many brilliant young people. I recently did some work with people in the rural area, young people, high school children, and they are so intelligent about this technology. They're smart people. What kind of future will they have? So not only our current workforce, but our workforce that's coming through the ranks, how are we going to balance it? So I don't have the answers, but I think all business leaders should be grappling with it. I think we can do a lot more in working together around this topic.
And just today, we had ABSA announcing a partnership with Amazon Web Services to boost cloud skills. And we are seeing very progressive moves, very much in the banking financial services sector, being driven in this space. Professor, from your vantage point, how do you see the university collaborating with business to ensure that you equipping the future workers and leaders with the skills that they need? And it doesn't just remain in the sort of academic ivory towers of studying Gaussian or Bayesian networks, for example.
Absolutely. I'm very impressed that you are quite well versed with Reverend Bayes' very famous contribution to AI. Now, you just touched the issue about ABSA and Amazon. What actually is happening is that data is the new oil. Now, you have to store this data. You have to process this data. So it is very important that we get into the cloud to store the data and to compute the data so that we can be able to monetize this. And the universities are exactly at the center of that. Firstly, we need to produce people with all the skills that are involved, because the skills are not almost, they're not obvious. I mean, people think it's only about the algorithm, the AI algorithm. Very, very important. It is also about data collection, data storage, data cleaning, so that you can be able to remove noise from data, and ultimately algorithmic design and so on and so forth. And what we are doing at the University of Johannesburg, we partner with various organizations around. For example, we have the NetBank chair, in this area of artificial intelligence. Professor Van Zyl is the professor involved for that. We need to get the people in practice to sit on our industrial boards so that they can shape our curriculum. We need to create short learning programs, which you already do. You have courses on artificial intelligence that you can come and you can learn all about it in 6 months, and you can be able to go into the business and do all these things. We need to invite some of the world leading experts in this area as university, together with the private sector, so that they can be able to tell us, what does it mean? Mm. What is the future of artificial intelligence, given the fact that quantum computing is becoming a reality, for example? What does it mean, algorithmic bias? What does it mean for South Africa's business community? Does it mean that those credit scoring that are being done in our financial institutions are legally invalid? All those things are very, very important, and they require us and the private sector to become a one system. Our academics must go and spend time in industry, and people in industry must be involved in what is happening at university.
I think that's a superb approach. And Johan, I know you've got young children. I've got a 6 and a 3-year-old, and I think very deeply about what kind of future is going to be awaiting them. What do you think we need to do in order to close the skills gap in South Africa in particular, to ensure that we're not left behind in this global fourth industrial revolution?
Like, my wake-up call was during that first few weeks of the hard lockdown last year, where I was homeschooling my 7-year-old son. The school was very good at delivering content through Dropbox and others, but I saw in him what I saw when I grew up, where education is very much a one-size-fits-all kind of an approach. And I started looking at alternative sources for him, and I found on his iPad some amazing games that teaches him engineering skills, critical thinking, problem solving. That is my worry if you think of not just in our country, but of our schooling system. I don't know if we are teaching our children to be ready for a future that, to a large extent, we can't really predict. Mm. I think we also have a gap in that our teachers are not necessarily skilled to teach the students and the learners about this kind of technology. Like Prof said in the event we had yesterday, you don't have to become an AI expert or a data scientist. But in every job you're going to go into, you're going to have to know what this technology is about. And back to the Prof's point just now, is this collaboration between government and industry. And I think maybe the starting point is, I don't think we realize what a critical problem this is and what a critical juncture we are. We can no longer sit around, wait for government. We all have to do something and collaborate.
Prof, there was a lot of fanfare when the 4-hour commission was announced. You were deputy to the president on that commission, but it has gone rather quiet of late. I know you came out with that report and the 8 points. Is that the end of your work? What happens with the commission's work from here?
Well, the commission's work was adopted by parliament, by cabinet, and it has to be implemented. And for that implementation to happen, we recommend that there has to be an implementation council made up of people drawn from all sectors of our society, particularly from the private sector, because this is where the expertise actually lies. So that is where we are. Some of the activities that have happened ever since, for example, there was a national AI dialogue, which was private sector led, where people came together to obviously support one of the key recommendations of the Fourth Industrial Revolution Commission, which is to establish the National AI Institute. So I think quite a bit of work is happening. It's just that it is not in the public eye. And I think the sooner we bring it to the public, the better.
In terms of the industry and the potential, as you said, Gaussian developments developed here in South Africa. The industry does seem to be rather fragmented. There are different chairs all over the place, different organizations seemingly doing their own thing. Is there a need to consolidate and bring the AI industry together in a more cohesive, consolidated manner?
No, absolutely. I mean, it is quite clear that if we are going, let me just give you an example. The issue of AI. You know, you have AI happening in universities, you have AI happening in science councils such as the CSIR, the Medical Research Council, the Agricultural Research Council to a certain extent. You have AI happening in the banking sector. A lot of AI is already happening in the automotive sector, but we do not have a unified voice. Now, the question that you would ask is, why should you have a unified voice? Wouldn't it kill your competitive edge as an industry? I think there are a number of issues that require a national response. For example, issues around regulations of data, availability of data, how it should be collected, and so on and so forth. I mean, one of my medical aid, my medical aid that I use, I'm not going to name it for fear of exposing them. The last time I visited the doctor, they said, "Would you like your data to be taken to a central database?" I said, "No. I know it is very advantageous for them, but it is disadvantageous for me because as a payer, it is good for them not to know my diseases, you know, and my disease profiles, you know, because otherwise, sooner or later, some people are going to fall off medical aid because they have certain diseases that cannot be risked well. You know? So, it's very, very important that we have to have a unified.
But it raises important questions about the ethics of the way we use these algorithms. You spoke in the first part of our conversation about credit scoring, credit vetting, biases that are actually coded in because these algorithms are still coded by humans at the end of the day. All very important conversations. Johan, what is business's role in ensuring there is a more cohesive view from the industry's perspective on the way the industry is regulated?
Michael, I speak to a lot of people in our own country who work in this field, and we have some amazing startups, we have some amazing established organizations, world-class AI and robotics organizations. But like Prof said, we're not working together, and I think it's challenging because if I had a company, I would want to innovate much quicker than my competitors. Mm. But how are we going to get people and businesses to start working together? So I think that's the first point, is we are definitely not far behind the rest of the world when it comes to the kind of talent that we have in this country. It's something that makes me very proud. We're going to have to figure out a way of working together. I work with some teachers in schools. It's doing amazing things only in certain schools. I think we need to look at the 8 points from the Commission. My personal view is that I think we need to start in education, potentially even healthcare. And there could be some organizations, Prof spoke about the banks and others, where if we use our skills in a way to, for instance, work in education, then the fear of competing with other banks and other insurance companies is, I think, no longer that much of an issue. But we need to find a way, some sort of a platform, to string all of these things together. I know, for instance, people who work with preschoolers who teach them the basics of coding, people work in primary and secondary, and then obviously as organizations like Harambe and Tomorrow Trust and others. But it seems like there's nothing that's pulling it together. A child starting in preschool will fall off somewhere in the process. How do we, and I alluded to it in my first segment, these youngsters that I meet in rural areas who are so intelligent, who are so talented, how do we get them when they're very little and make sure it's a unified process with other organizations working together to give them almost a guaranteed job placement that's meeting somewhere? That is a challenge. It's the getting everyone together somewhere or another. And I don't think it's government's job. We are going to have to figure out how to do that.
Yeah, I think that is one thing that is loud and clear. We can't rely on the state to lead. On that point, Professor, what's your view on the proposed state digital infrastructure company? There were draft regulations published, or a draft piece of legislation published recently, and really the role that the state should be playing in all of this, considering the history, if you look at CETA and other agencies that have been woefully inadequate.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think there is clear leadership deficit when it comes to technological matter in the state. So I am not in support of a wholly state-led data institute, because when I just think about what is involved, data storage, data computing, artificial intelligence, and other data algorithms, I can't see how we will be able to build such a high-tech capabilities in the state. You know, I actually think that an institute like this must at the least be a public-private partnerships with huge amounts of expertise coming from the private sector.
In terms of PPPs, and you speak often about them, how would you like to see those structured, broadly speaking, in the sector? Would it be a model where government provides incentives, tax incentives or others, and really we just use the best skills in the private sector to drive outcomes? How do you see that being structured?
Well, ideally, I would like the government to use the incentive instrument. That is why one of the key recommendations of the Fourth Industrial Revolution is about incentives. And government must actually govern, put the governance structures. I will just give you an example. We just completed the governance framework for the use of AI in the medical domain for the World Health Organization. This is what our government is supposed to be doing. Now, when we try to build a Facebook, because that's really what we are doing, if we start building a state-owned enterprise data company, we are building our own Facebook or Twitter, and I don't think we're going to be competitive, and I think it is going to see the same fate that CETA actually saw, which was the inability to do what it was supposed to do.
Considering what you've just said and what you write about in your book, there are two roads. There are various scenarios, but there's really a high and a low road. And there's one where we take advantage of the opportunities present. We actually start working together. We collaborate. And we prosper as a result. And the other one is just missing the boat altogether. Are you more optimistic or are you more pessimistic about our future, considering what's happening right now in the country?
Well, I think it's a mixture of both, and ultimately, what it is going to be. It will depend on what kind of choices we are going to make. Of course, we are optimistic because this technology is going to bring much, much more efficiency. We will be able to do things that we traditionally did much, much more effectively. And the capital formation that is going to result out of that can be actually be huge. The business opportunities can be huge. But of course, in that process, we know about, you've already talked about the job displacement that is going to happen. The future of work is a big question mark. Of course, if you look at the scale of that job displacement, you can't help but be pessimistic about it. But whether it is going to be an optimistic future or a pessimistic future is what we do as far as investing in human capacity development is concerned. As far as putting the infrastructure into place, whether it is the National AI Institute, whether it is the connectivity infrastructure that requires an effective and efficient way of allocating spectrum, the incentives that we are going to put down so that the small and medium enterprises can become big players in our economy, and the regulatory framework that we put into place to make sure that South Africa becomes a winner in this new era, not a loser.
Thank you very much. That was Professor Tlhidi Marwala, Vice Chancellor, Research and Internationalization at the University of Johannesburg, and Deputy Chair of the Presidential Commission on 4IR, and Johan Steyn, Chair of the Institute of Information Technology Professionals South Africa Special Interest Group on Artificial Intelligence and Robotics, talking about the urgency to make the right choices to take advantage of these technologies that are going to shape the future of the world.